This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Monday. Matt Patrick here, a cast of characters, to say the least. Hey, Patrick, how was your weekend, my friend?
It was good. Wished I hadn't watched The Wild, but can't be helped.
You know what I was very happy with? It was unfortunate they lost yesterday. But that Gopher softball team, they're pretty good. And they unfortunately lost their first game on Friday, I think it was, in the L.A. Regional. They had to play at UCLA, which was the number two seed. And then, of course, they had to play a bunch of other California schools. So they were really the only road team in the place. They lost, but then they absolutely kicked caboose the next day and won both in the consolation bracket. And then they had the real challenge. They had to beat UCLA twice. They were up 1-0 for a while, but UCLA got them. And 2-1, they fell. But that was a fun team, and you know they the Big Ten. There are some sports and some conferences that get a lot of attention. Softball in the Big Ten does not get a lot, but they've got good teams, and it's unfortunate that every year we are in the playoffs, we have to play, you know, someplace way on the road, in hostile territory. Even though I could make an argument that we probably should be at least a little closer here, but you know. That was pretty good. Did you catch any of Mickelson winning the PGA Championship?
I was following that. I'm not a big golf guy, but that was really impressive. That was cool.
When did they Happy Gilmore golf? Did you see the coverage of the 18th hole yesterday?
I didn't.
Okay, so golf, I get it. It's a sport like any other sport. But it basically looked like the golfers were walking down a frat house initiation line as they're trying to finish out their game. And apparently the guy that was playing with Mickelson had a knee injury, and multiple people kind of hit his knee as he was trying to just play the final hole. And I'm like wondering, did the PGA think this is a good idea to turn this into, you know, drunken white guy fest? Because that's what it was. It was drunken white guy fest. And, you know, it's one of the reasons why, you know, every once in a while you get a good story in golf, but then you see golf and you see what it is. And it's just wealthy white people being kind of trashy wealthy white people. And I'm like, not the golfers per se. I mean, they're all fairly talented. But it just, yeah, that was unfortunate that was the outcome there. I did get the garden planted as best I can because I'm having a little bit of health issues, still working on that. So I recruited the kids and, you know, gave them zero choice, got the gardens planted just in time for every one of my silver maples to drop their helicopters. Ugh, dang it. So now I got to go clean those all on out. And then, yeah, I went for a nice drive yesterday. I went down to Carver County. Well, it was a nice drive down. The way back wasn't bad because I had to come through that really nasty storm down by Jordan. And there was an accident on the side of the road. It looked like a truck had hit a three-wheel motorcycle. You seen those?
Ooh.
Well, yeah. It was not. Can I make this plea to the woman who, I don't know if you were in the accident with a three-wheel motorcycle or you were just trying to be a good Samaritan. But she had pulled her vehicle over to the right shoulder and gotten out to where she was standing in the right-hand lane. She was standing there. And obviously, people were going slow. It was raining really heavy and stuff. But you've done your job. Put on your hazards. Get yourself out of the road. Because by the grace of God, that woman herself didn't get hit. Ugh, you got to be careful out there. Got to be careful out there. I mean, if you're in an accident or if you just want to help out, pull it aside, get your flashes on, but you yourself, don't sit there on the side of the road. As a guy that did metro traffic for many years, can't tell you how many people get injured that way. That is a very dangerous way to do it. I also wanted to give a big salute to the Minnesota DFL. Now, I'm going to give this to the DFL, but I want to make sure I put this caveat forward. Religious disclaimer, I always say this. I'm Catholic. You do or don't do whatever it is you do or don't want to do. I'm Catholic. Part of my religious faith, part of my personal spiritual faith, is the need to help others who are at a base point of need. You're hungry, get you food. You need shelter, get you inside. You need health care, we'll get you to a hospital. You know, that is the kind of one of the base things for me. That has been a driving compass in my life. I don't care if any organization does a food bank. Do not care. You could be Paul Gazelka's campaign. If you're handing out free food, I will gladly help promote that. You could be the most far right-wing church. If you are out there in a parking lot and there are no caveats, you're just basically handing out baskets of food, I will gladly help you promote your event. Because that is a major thing for me. And that goes way beyond politics. It goes way beyond individual ideology. It goes much further to the idea of you just being a decent human being, for goodness sakes. So I got the call, and in this case, the DFL had a whole bunch of food coming in on Sunday. And as a matter of fact, it sounded like they actually doubled the amount of food they were going to get. So I actually got some help from Robert Pilot and some other people. We helped spread the word. They gave out tons of free food to the great people of St. Paul. They were giving it out on Plato Boulevard yesterday. Fresh food, that farm-to-family program they got. Fresh food, fresh cheese, fresh meats. This is not, you know, stuff that's been in a storage. This is good quality stuff. And they wanted to make sure all that got out there. And they got into the needy communities of St. Paul. They got that all distributed. I want a big salute to Marge Hoffa, Ken Martin, the whole crew over at the DFL, all the volunteers. Nicely done. Nicely done. That is, you know, caring for Minnesotans. When you care for the least of us, that's the most important thing. And so I was... When I got the call saying, hey, can you help get the word out? Not that. That got me lit up a little bit. Yeah, sure. What do we have to do? And so all my best to everyone out there who got that great food. I hope you enjoy that there. And once again, I sincerely challenge me. Challenge me. Seriously, challenge me. If you are a conservative far right group and you're doing a food giveaway, a food bank, all people have to do is drive up, and it's not about filling out voter registration forms or anything like that. It's just you drive up, pick up some food, drive away. You got something like that happening, I will gladly promote it. Gladly promote it, because that for me is so important. That just for me is just a base core thing. And yeah, I'm glad that they got that done. 952-946-6205. Metz is going to join us a little bit later on. Why? Because it's Bob Dylan's birthday. And the next 2 days are going to be a fairly deep retrospective few days. I should say the segment with Paul. I want to start off, I guess, by talking about how the birthday of Bob Dylan reminded me that, yeah, it had been a year since what happened to George Floyd. I remember it being Dylan's birthday, and I remember saying, do I do anything about Bob Dylan's birthday? It's his 79th. It's kind of an odd duck of a birthday. Nice run. Can't deny the guy's influence, but do I do something for his 79th birthday or do I wait until next year? And I remember making the conscious effort, and there's a lot of coverage in the media about, you know, of course, Dylan, and there is today, of course, about whether or not I did a segment on him last year, and I didn't. I decided not to. And I remember even well into the next day, the, you know, Dylan kind of wondering if I should have done something. And then, of course, the tragedy of George Floyd happened. That is tomorrow. That's the anniversary tomorrow. And I think that it is an interesting dichotomy here in Minnesota to have, you know, have two people whose names will live forever because of two Minnesotans whose names will far beyond the borders of this state, far beyond the borders of this country. The names of Bob Dylan and George Floyd will live on. And the importance of both of them, I mean, they're not, you know, it's not necessarily we can compare the impact of either to each other per se outside of the large ripples that each has caused within society. But it is amazing to me the way things have changed does come. Tomorrow is going to be a tough day. It's going to be a very tough day for me. It's going to be a tough day for a lot of people. The main thing I think we should probably focus on as we go through this week and go through commemorating George Floyd and what the insane American tragedy that happened to that man. The awakening of what has been transpiring within the African-American communities, the undeniable violent nature of some police officers within some police departments. We have an opportunity to take this man's legacy and make real change. Now, white guy, I'll be the first to admit it, white guy. So my perspective on this is one of a different trajectory than anyone within the minority community. And for me to even try to vocalize or, you know, kind of capture that is, I think, is foolish because it's not something that I can fully understand as a white person. But what I can say is this. This crap needs to end. I went back. I talked about the food shelf. And I talked about how when a base core influence for me is feeding people. Treat all people the same. I don't care who you are. I don't care who you are. I don't. You live your life, and if you can find a life where you're happy, my God, is that a blessing. And yet, the problem we have in our society is that there are just too many people that don't want to let other people live their own life. They don't want to give them the fair chance. They've convinced themselves that their fight was so much harder than it really was, while downplaying the undeniable problems and societal challenges of others. We can change this. You can say, Black Lives Matter. I'm a white guy. I'm not threatened by that. I'm not a weak, weak person. I can say Black Lives Matter. I can say Native American Lives Matter. Say Hmong Lives Matter. I can say Latino Lives Matter. Hispanic Lives Matter. All Lives Matter. But I can also, I don't have to say All Lives Matter. I can say Black Lives Matter. And you know why? It's because white people don't have the same damn problems as Black people do. And so we have to bring awareness to the Black experience in this country. And it is more than a few Oscar awards or Grammy nominations. It's more than a hit show on Netflix. It is a cultural change we have to make, that when you see someone, no matter their race, religion, creed, sexual orientation, anything, you see one thing, a human being. I've said this before, I'll say this again. When it comes to the question I get asked by bigots, they say, what race are you part of? I say the human race. And yeah, guilty as charged. I've stuck my head in the ground too freaking long. But I'm done. After this year, God, I am done. We're fixing this. And it might not come tomorrow. And it might not come in the next few weeks or months or years. Oh, I guarantee you this Generation Z coming up, I got three kids in Gen Z. Holy God, they're going to change a lot of things. Hopefully it doesn't take that long. But this is going to end one way or the other, for the betterment of us all. Because at the end of the day, even in the hearts of the most bigoted racists in this country, you're still a human being. Act like it. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll come on back. The Minnesota coronavirus update. We'll do that when we come on back. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show on your Monday. Pandemic measures improved across the board on Monday. Yay. When Minnesota reported zero COVID-19 deaths. Yay. Fewer hospitalizations and 10 straight days of fewer than 1,000 new coronavirus infections. Well, that's 1,000. That's 10 straight days of fewer than 1,000. The seven-day rolling average of new infections in Minnesota has dropped 61% since the start of May, with only 469 more infections being reported in the state on Monday. The number of inpatient hospital beds filled with COVID-19 cases has dropped as well, from 699 on April 14th to 378 on Sunday. That's down dramatically. State health officials have commended Minnesota's vaccination progress for reducing COVID-19 levels despite the presence of more infectious variants of the coronavirus. More than 2.8 million people have received at least the first dose of COVID-19 vaccination, and more than 2.5 million of them have completed the one or two dose series. That means that 63.5% of Minnesotans 65 and older, more than 89% of the state's vulnerable senior citizens, have received at least some COVID vaccine. God, can you believe we're going to have 90%? Of the senior citizen vaccinated. Absolutely outstanding. Nearly 59,000 people, 12 to 15, have received shots as well since they opened up that vaccine, the Pfizer vaccine, from the age of 16 down to 12 years old 2 weeks ago. The pandemic overall has caused 7,370 COVID deaths, 599,234 infections found through diagnostic testing. The progress comes ahead of Minnesota's scheduled removal on Friday of remaining capacity caps and social distancing requirements on indoor bars, restaurants, and entertainment venues. A state mask mandate was lifted 2 weeks ago, though some businesses in the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul still require that they be worn in public locations to reduce the threat of viral transmission. The state is reporting a decline as well in bar and restaurant outbreaks, which are defined as infections involving seven customers from the different households who only reported going to one establishment in the past month. Eight such outbreaks had been reported so far in the week ending on May 22nd. The four were reported in the prior week. 50 outbreaks were reported during the peak of the pandemic wave. Yeah, they were having big problems with that. So that's good to see that's dying down. I will say, be careful where you're going. A lot of people are traveling. I had a friend who kind of, you know, he wants to follow the rules, went to California, didn't realize California still is a mask mandate. So you had to wear masks and didn't think anything of it. And actually kind of the police came over and said, "I may need to be wearing a mask." He was very apologetic, but some states still have mask mandates in place. You need to make sure you check to see where if you're going someplace, where that's at. Some have partial, depending on where you're at. So you got to keep an eye on that. But another thing that I think is just a magnificent little gem here. Five Minnesota counties have now more than 70% of adults 16 plus with at least one shot. Cook, Olmsted, Hennepin, Ramsey, and now over the weekend, Fillmore County. Hello, Fillmore. Nicely done. That is gets us five. Washington County should be there fairly soon. They're currently at 68.8%. I'm kind of surprised. I think it's Cook County is the very northeastern part of the state. The county next to it is a tiny little one called Lake County between Cook and St. Louis County. There, how many people do you think are even in Lake County, man?
Probably about 7,000, 8,000.
7,000, 8,000. I know. I go, okay, what is it? Is Lutzen there?
No, Lutzen's in Cook County. Two harbors is Lake County.
Okay, so there's two harbors. What's taking them so long? For goodness sake. It's not, I mean, it's like we could go up there and you and I could go take care of that. Hey, you, come here. Hey, just roll up your sleeve. Don't ask a question. So there you go. I'm not surprised there. I will say St. Louis County, which is huge, which, of course, Duluth, that almost is, that's getting up into the 60 to 70%, which is great as well. And many, of course, of the metro area counties as well doing fairly well there. Please, once again, get vaccinated. This is easy. This is a no-brainer. There's a lot of counties in the Republican parts of the state. As a matter of fact, you run 94 out to the northwest of us. Most of the counties on the north side of 94, they're not doing too well. Go get vaccinated, please. I do not want you in a year, 2 years, 5 years, all of a sudden coming down with coronavirus. Because we don't know we don't know where you things will be at. We don't know what variant you might have to deal with. So please, beg of you, get vaccinated. It's easy. Most places, there's no reservation needed. You can walk right in, and you're done. And I've got my kids. All my kids are getting vaccinated. My one kid who's between 16 and 12, she's getting vaccinated now. I would highly encourage you to take advantage of that as well. We're all safer together, okay? We're all safer together. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Let's take a break. Come on back. Oh, what's that about another fake candidate from the GOP? We'll talk about that. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Once again, it's going to be a pleasure to welcome Paul Metz in to talk about Dylan's 80th birthday later on today. At about 5:30, we'll talk to Paul Metz up on the Iron Range. The Governor Tim Walz has issued a proclamation asking Minnesotans to observe a moment of silence in honor of the one-year anniversary of George Floyd's death. Walz called for the moment of silence at 1 p.m. on Tuesday for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. George Floyd's murder ignited a global movement and awakened many Minnesotans and people around the world to the systemic racism in our black communities, indigenous communities, and communities of color have known for centuries. Walz's proclamation states on April 20th, 2021, a jury found Chauvin guilty of Floyd's murder. This historic verdict was a step in the right direction, but our work to dismantle systemic racism and discrimination has not ended. True justice for George Floyd will come only through real systemic change to prevent acts like this from happening again. When every member of every community, no matter their race, is safe, valued, and protected, Floyd died when he was arrested by Minneapolis police. And while former officer Derek Chauvin knelt on his neck, Chauvin was found guilty of murder and manslaughter in Floyd's death last month. The other three former officers are scheduled to go on trial next year. You know, 1 o'clock tomorrow is obviously a good time to do it. I would also suggested, if I remember, I'm trying to remember the timeline here. If the paramedics arrived, the paramedic that pulled Chauvin off of Floyd arrived at, I think it was 8:29. So I would also, I think I might just do a 9 minute and 29 second moment of silence starting about 8:19 tomorrow, because that would truly be the 1 year moment. And yeah. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Fox 9 had a bit of an eye-opener this morning. A story. We've talked now for months about how the Republicans seem to have run a lot of fake third-party pro-marijuana candidates. And now I've said, and I think I said just recently when the House passed the pro-marijuana bill, I don't think the Senate wants to pass this bill because the Senate, the Republicans need to have fake third party candidates running to try to take votes away from the Democrats, from the DFL. And it's been something they had that case down in CD2. We've talked about the guy that was running in Shakopee with Mortensen. Well, now we have, it becomes pretty undeniable. When you have this happening border to border, north to south, east to west, across the entire dang state, it's pretty clear that this was a far more coordinated effort than just one guy. Let's just be honest about that. The story from Fox 9, blind and permanently disabled Kevin Nisi Shores is accustomed to navigating life's obstacles, but has never stopped him from pursuing his third-party political ambitions. Still, he was surprised by the unsolicited call he got in June of 2020 from a man who encouraged him to run against Congressman Colin Peterson as a candidate for the Grassroots Legalized Cannabis Party. I was under the impression he was part of that political party, Shore says. That was my assumption. He was wrong. Unknown to Shores, the man who had called, encouraging him to run, was a Republican strategist, Kip Christensen, who at the time was on the payroll of the Republican National Committee, according to the Federal Elections Commission. So I want to make sure we understand something. At the time Kip Christensen called this man to encourage him to run against a DFLer, not as a Republican, but as a third-party candidate, he was on the payroll of the RNC. On the date of the filing deadline, June 2nd, 2020, Shores said Christensen made a 7-hour round trip to pick up his notarized affidavit of candidacy in Moorhead and deliver it to the Secretary of State's office in St. Paul 45 minutes before the filing deadline. Shores said Christensen also paid the $300 filing fee with a money order. So once again, this Christensen character paid the money for it. I said, how much is the filing fee? Shores says, I asked, how much is the filing fee? And the Christensen says, don't worry about it. And again, I'm assuming this is the Grassroots Cannabis Party, Shores said. Shores said he only learned Christensen was working for the Republican Party after the election. Christensen, a Harvard graduate from Monticello, has a resume that includes being a Trump delegate at the 2016 Republican National Convention in Cleveland, a treasurer for the Minnesota Young Republicans, and a candidate tracker for the Minnesota Jobs Coalition. He also ran unsuccessfully for the Minnesota Party co-chair. Christensen told Fox 9 investigators he never misrepresented himself as a member of the Grassroots Legalized Cannabis Party. But when asked specifically if ever told Shores he was a paid Republican strategist, Christensen said, no comment. Dude, you don't have, there is no toehold you got here, okay? You did, yeah, I never misrepresented myself. I never said anything. Dude, you must think we're all that stupid. Because, dude, So once again, his whole thing, did you ever tell Shores you are a paid Republican strategist? Christensen said, no comment. In a statement, a spokesman for the Republican National Committee denied any role in recruiting Shores under false pretenses. The RNC has no knowledge of this, nor would we have authorized anything like what is being alleged, said RNC spokesperson Priya Samsunder. Christensen's alleged deception of Shores and the extent he went to facilitating Shores' candidacy has not been previously reported. It does, however, fit a broader and well-documented pattern of Republicans, or at least supporters of President Trump, running for office as third-party candidates in swing legislative and congressional districts in an apparent attempt to siphon votes from Democratic candidates. The Minnesota Reformer had previously reported that many of those legislative candidates in 2020 had social media posts supportive of Trump and conservative issues, but little in the way of advocating for legalizing cannabis. The Ringers ran on either the grassroots Legalized Cannabis Party or the Legal Marijuana Now Party. Both parties have major party status in Minnesota because they achieved more than 5% of the vote in a statewide election, which means it's not necessary to collect signatures to get on the ballot. The most high-profile case, of course, was Adam Weeks, the organic farmer who ran for Congress in Minnesota's 2nd Congressional District under the Legal Marijuana Now Party. Weeks died from a fentanyl overdose 42 days before the general election in November, but still pulled 6% of the vote. Third-party candidate for Minnesota's 2nd Congressional District, the candidate for the Minnesota 2nd Congressional District, Weeks left for a friend on May 20th, 2020. He said he'd been recruited by unnamed Republicans in CD2 who offered him $15,000 for his campaign. They want me to run as a third-party liberal candidate. I can play the liberal, you know that, against Angie Craig and that other guy. He was talking about Tyler Kistner. Weeks said, as the recording obtained by Fox 9 investigators, I go to the guy and say, what if he win? What if I win? He said, we'll deal with that later, Weeks said in the voicemail. Oliver Steinberg, a grassroots legalized cannabis candidate for U.S. Senate, said the strategy is working. I imagine it will be quadruple in 2022, Steinberg said. Once again, going back to my theory, the reason why the Republicans have no chance at passing legal marijuana is they need the fake third-party candidates. On the affidavit for Kennedy's file for the Secretary of State, candidates must affirm that they are participated in the party's most recent precinct caucuses or intended to vote for the majority of that party's candidates. These people who are filing didn't even know the name of the party they were filing for. Steinberg says that no one enforces that, even if they could, because voting is confidential. But the recruit, well, I mean, wait a minute here. You should have some way to determine if someone has participated in the party's most recent precinct caucuses, though. That's not confidential. That's just you show up at the caucus, right? So it's, yeah, I you could enforce that. You just are not choosing to. But the recruitment of Kevin Shores is particularly egregious, he said. The man's a disabled veteran. He's blind, Steinberg said. Much to Kevin Shores' surprise, he lost a primary opponent, Ray Hart Anderson, who's run twice as a Republican. So, once again, I want to make sure I mention this. In CD7, they had recruited Shores, but they had apparently also, it sounds like, recruited Ray Hart Anderson, who is a Republican, to also run as a legalized marijuana candidate. I think you just got to be relentless at this point with all these candidates. If there's a pro-pot candidate, you need to basically camp out on their door, and because that's the one thing that these guys are not expecting. None of these people, they all say, oh, I just got to file the paperwork. I don't have to do anything else. You need to camp out on their door and start asking questions. Because every one of them sounds like a fraud. David Schultz, an expert in election law at Hamline, said, while there is nothing at all wrong about encouraging people to run for office, the recruitment of Kevin Shores may have actually crossed the line. The deception really changes or reframes the story to make it look like someone is being tricked and someone is being offered something of value as part of that trick, Schultz says. State law says a person may not be reward or promise a reward another in any manner to induce the person or refrain them from being a candidate. Schultz said there is maybe nothing illegal about paying a candidate $300 filing fee. It must be disclosed as an in-kind campaign contribution. If I give, that's why I used it. That's why I used a cashier's check. That's why I used a traveler's check, because so that he, you know, they could just kind of do it off the books. If it gives something of value to someone in order to encourage them to run or not run, that violates state law. The problem, Schultz says, is there's no watchdogs anymore. While Minnesota may do great things with voter turnout, he said, the state has become notoriously weak at regulating campaigns and fair practices. It's not just about winning races anymore, he says. It's about undermining the process. What is happening here is the very rules of the game are being challenged and undermined, and a situation like this is really pointing the changing nature of American politics. Sounds like every reason the situation like this is really pointing the changing American politics and how parties are not willing to play fair anymore. Sounds like the very reason Kevin Shores wanted to run for Congress. He just didn't know who was signing him up or the end game. I call them the powers that should not be, says Shores. You know, this is who these people are. The Republicans cannot win fair elections. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that there aren't districts that will elect them. Of course they will. But they cannot win fair elections. So they have to find ways that cheat. And the reality is this is not just this guy, Kip Christensen. I've heard enough stories and enough innuendo about actual Republicans being the people to make the call and try to recruit these candidates that I'm actually kind of shocked we can't do more to crack down on this. Now, the DFL did, I think, a fairly good idea in going the legalized marijuana route. I think it takes a lot of wind out of these third-party sales, because the reality is you can be a third-party candidate. You might win one seat, but you're not going to change anything in St. Paul. The DFL, on the other hand, is a large party. It's got a good chunk of the seats. You can change a lot of things. They have the House. They can legalize marijuana. So you kind of take a lot of wind out of their sails with that argument. But I am flabbergasted that there can't be more of an investigation here. Because if I'm the Attorney General of the state of Minnesota and I know there's a political party, particularly the political party that's running into me, is running fake third-party candidates, and there seems to be multiple evidence of actual people involved with the Republican Party instigating this, well, then I would actually call for, you know, get affidavits and get phone records and computer logs and find out exactly who is saying what to whom. It doesn't do you any good to get to the point where you know what's going on, but then you just, oh, we got our stern wagon finger out. Oh, waggy, 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 waggy. You got to make these people pay. Now, if all of a sudden you dragged a fairly prominent Republican out and said, here are emails where they're coordinating, or here's phone messages where they're coordinating with Republican officials on, you know, finding third-party candidates, well, then all of a sudden you disgrace them across the board. But, you know, the problem here is this, and this is a very much the ugly truth. When you look at CD7, to a point, CD2, you have a lot of media in those towns that just don't ask that question. They will not ask that question. Is the third-party candidate a legitimate candidate? Is the third-party candidate real? Or is this just some plant by the Republican Party? Because at the end of the day, there's a lot of media in those districts which want the Republican to win. So they just don't care. So this does come on down to whether or not this should be legal. I can guarantee you this. if the DFL or people associated with the DFL started running moderate Republican Party candidates in all these districts, I guarantee you the same Republican Party, which seems to be very eagerly running these third-party cannabis party candidates, would quickly be saying, how dare you? You're not supposed to do what we're doing. I mean, that's dishonest. Of course they would. Because, and once again, what are we looking at? Republicans are banking on Democrats not playing the game like they do. And frankly, I'm to the point of why not? Why not? If you know, Matt, we're honest. We're the honest ones. Yeah, okay. Yeah, we're getting our butts kicked. You know, tell that to Shakopee. Tell that to Shakopee. We're putting on the honest. And I'll tell you what. I guarantee you this. You'll clear this whole problem if all of a sudden one day in next summer, all of a sudden a bunch of independent, moderate Republican candidates propped up in a whole bunch of House races across the state where it was going to be borderline, where they could basically take away half the votes of the Republican Party. The day, I mean, Gazelka himself would be screaming for a new law to get passed about, you know, third-party candidates have to be truly independent of anyone else. And they'd walk away from it. But you see, that's not going to happen until basically they get a taste of their own medicine. And even with all this press and even with all this visibility and even being caught red-handed again, they're not going to change. They're not going to change. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. Yeah, Republicans they're making all these voter laws to make it harder for Democrats to vote. They've redistricted. They've gerrymandered. They are in Texas right now. They're trying to shut down something like 70% of all DFL area polling places while expanding Republican polling places. No joke. That's actually being considered down there. You know, and then even if the Democrats do pull the win out, what's their next strategy? To deny them, to not validate the election, to call the entire election a fraud, and they see is the problem that they have is they can't have another election. So they're trying to figure out ways to throw out an election and install a Republican as the winner by just saying, well, we negated the votes for the Democrats, so that means the winner now is the Republican. That's what their goal is at this point. And, you know, and I'm of the mindset, too, that I'm sorry, there is going to be at least 12 to 15 states in 2024 that if the Democrats win the presidential election, they will not, even if their state voted for them, they will not vote to, they'll do everything in their power to basically prevent that election from being recognized. And like I said, we're on the precipice of democracy failing here. Because once you do that, you're not going to be able to walk that back. You're not going to be able to walk that back. Once you basically start throwing out legitimate elections and saying, no, our guy won. I mean, what was the story? That was the Maricopa, Arizona GOP chair got a call from Giuliani in the days after the election saying, we can fix this so it works out for all of us. Oh, yeah, it works out for the Republicans by throwing out the legal voting tallies for Arizona and giving it to the Republicans. You know, once you do that, there's no walking back. But this is, at the end of the day, this is where I think the Republicans are going. They want to secede, which is funny because I got into a discussion this weekend with a guy about what would happen if some of these states actually did secede. Now, they're not going to, because then all of a sudden they stop for a second and realize that the federal government's not going to help them anymore, that they're going to be on their own, and that they have to start their own country, including a military and all that good stuff, and that's going to be pricey. But let's just say, for argument's sake, that, okay, so say Georgia decides they're going to secede. And, you know, and I say Georgia because Marjorie Taylor Greene, and she brought up secession. If let's say that they're going to secede, and the U.S. government's okay with it. So just, it's a fantasy. It's not going to happen. But let's just say it did. What would be amazing is as we got close to them actually leaving the Union, the exodus of people out of that state would be insane. Because people wouldn't want to be there knowing what was coming. And as a matter of fact, all of a sudden it would probably dawn on a lot of these Republicans, well, we're not going to have workers. So my guess is they would have to shut down the border. Think about that. Prevent people from leaving as they try to secede because they need people to flip burgers and make them, Chick-fil-A. You think I'm joking? No, of course not. It's not about caring about the people. It's about power. And all of this is about power. That's all the Republicans are about, is power. And they will cheat, lie, and destroy democracy itself to maintain that power that they do have. And, you know, I think if it becomes too apparent to them that they can't win under their current model, that they will actually try to torpedo democracy and just say, okay, we'll go with a dictatorship because if that's how we stay in power, that's how we stay in power. Hour two, we got Paul Metza coming up here talking about Dylan. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Once again, on your Monday, 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. There is a story. I know, Patrick, you're a big fan of the Snapchat and the Instagram and the kids and the Zumbas and all that good stuff. Did you see there's apparently a Snapchat of an individual in Hayfield, Minnesota, who climbed one of the water towers there and then live streamed it?
I am not aware of this, but my dad was from Hayfield, and so I can completely see this happening.
Why? Can I ask why?
Well, I mean, what else are you going to do on a Saturday?
It doesn't seem like it has the longest list of activities. The appeal was issued by, they're trying to identify this individual, the Dodge County Sheriff's Office, who described the man as an idiot. That's their description, in quotes. As it asked for anyone who knows him to come forward, the guy decided to climb the Hayfield Water Tower last week, live-streamed it on Snapchat, said Sheriff Scott Rose. We're looking for the public's help to identify this idiot so we can properly welcome him to the county with a trespassing ticket. Rose told the Post-Bulletin that police only became aware of the incident on Monday, but the climber had posted the Snapchat basically on Tuesday the 18th. He added that it's a concern that there would be a copycat incidents. There are serious safety concerns, including mounted equipment on the tower. Judging by the railings in the background, it looked like he was climbing the old Hayfield Water Tower. Apparently, there's two water towers in Hayfield. This would be the old one, a little more iconic looking, I guess you would say, in regards to that. When was the last time you were in Hayfield? Can I ask?
I actually think I might have driven through there about 2 months ago. Huh.
Wasn't you climbing it, was it?
Maybe. No.
Don't. The way the Dodge County Sheriff's Office is looking for this guy, no, that wasn't Patrick. I'm going to save you right now. I don't want him coming knocking on the door here. Don't do that. They just had the guy, the one of the mills. They had some kids that were in one of the mills. They got the guy fell. He's seriously injured. They had some other kids that got trapped in one of the mills over about 2 or 3 weeks ago, or two or three days ago. They had to get the police to get them out of there. And, of course, they're, you know, now dealing with trespassing. So don't do that. Don't do that, okay? And, you know, get cable. You know, have you tried? Did you see Army of the Dead? Army of the Dead? It's average. It's not great. It's not bad. It's better than most summer movies. Go watch that. That's on Netflix. Then you don't have to do that. 952-946-6205. All right. Out of the desire to be fair, because last hour I talked about fake Republican, fake pro-marijuana candidates who have been coordinated by people involved with the Republican Party. That technique is not something that is exclusive to one side of the aisle. And the Minnesota Reformer actually has a fairly sensational article here, research, on what could only be described as a similar manipulation of a manipulation attempt of the people to try to get them on board with less serious police reforms. Bit of a long story here, but it's a good read because what you've got here is not only the police, not only the mayor's office, but allegations a member of the city council as well is working, or at least unintentionally working with these people to drive a certain narrative. Bill Rodriguez was the first speaker at a first public hearing on cutting funding to the Minneapolis Police Department. We need both the police and reform, Rodriguez said at the city council meeting in November. Variation of that phrase, we need both, were repeated throughout the hearing. It is the signature talking point of Operation Safety Now, the pro-police group Rodriguez founded. Rodriguez was pleased with how the hearing went. Seems like the first half was overwhelmingly pro-Minneapolis police. The second half more balanced, he later wrote, to Natasha Hansen, the executive assistant for police chief Miranda Arredondo. Rodriguez was writing to Hansen because, though he claimed the Star Tribune's opinion piece to be just concerned citizen with no government connections, Rodriguez was working closely with Arredondo's office. 10 days before the public hearing, Rodriguez ran draft language for the Operation Safety Now website past the chief's office for review. Robin McPherson, the police department's director of financial operations. Once again, this is the official police department director of financial operations replying, I am copying the chief on this email as well. He's a much better wordsmith than I, and I may want to offer some details. This and other emails obtained from the city of Minneapolis through a reformer public records request show that both the Minneapolis Police Department and Mayor Jacob Frey's office collaborated with Operation Safety Now to lobby city council members to sway public opinion in the hopes of winning increased funding for the MPD. As part of their campaign to lobby council member Alondra Cano, Rodriguez and his associate Eric One, W-O-N, offered to use One's influence, including a seat on the Minneapolis's Capital Long Range Improvement Committee, to benefit businesses in Cano's ward. Cano then met with the men, arranged a meeting between them and business owners, and later supported their position on a key police budget vote. The emails after offer a window into the help Arredondo and to a lesser extent Frey had received from the political operators as they engaged in a fierce lobbying campaign against the opponents on the city council who want to take control of the department and fundamentally change it. So what we have now, and just as you step back, you have a quote-unquote grassroots committee who clearly was coordinating to a point with the police department to try to sway public opinion. And sounds like they were working in some capacity with the mayor's office. And it's not clear how much the city council members were aware of this, but they clearly were a receptive ear. How about I say it like that? Council member Andrew Johnson called the coordination between Arredondo and an outside political group to lobby the public and the council pretty unprecedented. I'd agree with that. After another recent rash of gun violence, the political conflict between the mayor and the council has reemerged, with Frey appearing side by side with the leaders behind Operation Safety Now. During a recent press conference announcing the plan to stem the violence, Frey echoed Rodriguez's November rhetoric, describing the plan as a both-and approach. Okay. During the police budget debate, Rodriguez worked so closely with Arredondo's office that it was practically integrated into the team. In one email, Rodriguez wrote to Arredondo's executive assistant asking her to arrange a meeting with Minneapolis Police Department Communications Director John Elder ASAP so Rodriguez and one could relay our conversation with the chief and the next steps. Arredondo's office also helped prepare the script for an Operation Safety Net video, encouraged Minneapolis residents to support the MPD at public hearings. Rodriguez and one have both said they are volunteers, but both are experienced hands in public affairs. They run consulting firms offering services that mirror their work on the campaign. Though Rodriguez had repeatedly claimed to be a Minneapolis resident, including by listing a South Minneapolis address where he signed up to speak on the November 16th meeting, he is registered to vote in Richfield. If you're registered to vote in Richfield, I'm pretty sure you're not a Minneapolis resident. I'm just going to say. Through the connection is never stated in public, Operation Safety Now is a project of another group, Minneapolis Voices. Operation Safety Now is not an incorporated nonprofit. It has no organizational structure and holds no member meetings, according to Karen Forbes, a member who spoke to the Reformer. Meanwhile, Minneapolis Voices is incorporated, and several politicos and business owners are identified in emails as leaders of the group. Fry's office declined to provide anyone to be interviewed, but wrote by email, the mayor's team did its best to engage with as many groups and residents as possible on defining issue for our city. The Minneapolis Police Department did not respond to requests for comments. Jeez. After initially agreeing to an interview, Rodriguez ultimately declined. One would not even respond to interview requests. Rodriguez, whose LinkedIn profile identifies him as a marketer and PR consultant, didn't start in the pro-MPD camp. In the days following Floyd's murder, he called critics to the defund movement ridiculous on Facebook and claimed the resulting chaos. He cites personal experience with crime for his shifting views. His South Minneapolis home was, now mind you, he's registered to vote apparently in Richfield, where we're back to his South Minneapolis home. His South Minneapolis home was burglarized in the middle of the night while he and his wife slept in their upstairs bedroom, KST reporter Jay Coles reported in September. Rodriguez told Coles that he and his wife waited in a closet for 15 minutes for the police to arrive, clutching a baseball bat. He gave a slightly different version of the story to the Southwest Journal in November, saying he only started paying any serious attention to crime after his ex-wife experienced an early morning home invasion. Despite telling council member Jeremy Schroeder that he's a resident of Ward 11, Rodriguez is currently registered to vote in Richfield. Court records list him as living there as early as 2008 and as late as November of 2019. He is occasionally posts in the Richfield, Minnesota Community Facebook group, where he's declared in 2015, "I'm a Richfield resident." Rodriguez also told Coles that the house is two doors down, had experienced the same incident that someone was going down the street in her neighborhood looking to see how they could pry open doors. According to the Minneapolis Police Department's online crime map, though, no other crimes took place within at least two blocks of the house that night. In early November, Rodriguez had become a trusted communication advisor to Arredondo. He wrote to Arredondo's executive assistant on November 3rd, seeking information about police staffing levels. Compiling the numbers, requiring input into the department's CFO, the commander of the Special Operations Division, a department analysis of the chief, Minneapolis Police Department had other information ready the next day. Rodriguez used the information to outline several infographics for the Safety Net Now website and sought revisions from the department. McPherson says the CFO forwarded the request to Arredondo so the chief could change the wording to coincide with some of the comments in the past. She wrote, the Minneapolis Police have provided the Minneapolis Police Department may have provided input on more than messaging. Rodriguez's proposed agenda for the November 18 meeting with Arredondo includes the item "Our Reform Position for Review." So, I mean, it's clear this group is just a front group for the cops. At least it seems to me, because all your wording, all your messaging seems to be trying to go through the police department. There doesn't seem to be too much organic about you. City Council President Lisa Bender called the collaboration between the Minneapolis Police Department and Safety Now frustrating because the Minneapolis Police Department often fails to provide information to council members in a timely fashion, which is a very legitimate argument. They want the same information. Apparently, the police don't respond that quickly. Rodriguez centered Arredondo, who is viewed favorably in Minneapolis residents, as a personality in his campaign. Email showed him working with the chief's office to outline the script for the interview. In the video produced, Arredondo encourages viewers to testify to the city council about Minneapolis Police Department funding. It ends with the interviewer, an Operation Safety Now member, saying, "You need more opportunities to get in front of the people to show your real self because we want a little bit more of you than what we're getting." Smiling, Arredondo replies, "Wow." The emails show that the mayor's office also coordinated with the group in the days leading up to the budget vote, although not as extensively as with the Minneapolis Police Department. I don't know how they could possibly have done it as extensively. In one email, Rodriguez suggested the mayor threaten a veto or anything other than his plan, asking, "Is that dumb, suicidal, premature, or bold and effective in continuing to help him recover a strong in-person persona?" The issue of the veto came up several times in emails between Rodriguez and the mayor's office. In one instance, Rodriguez wrote a form letter for the public to encourage council members to support the mayor's budget and submitted a draft to Frey's office for revision. The mayor's office struck a line explicitly calling for more police and one accusing the city council of a ploy to defund and downsize, but kept the line encouraging Frey to veto the budget if this city council continues to handcuff our police chief. In the end, Frey threatened to veto over staffing levels. Interesting. I'm going to come on back because I want to. So there you have a connection here between Rodriguez, clearly a massive connection with the Minneapolis Police Department. So there's a level of dishonesty there, I think. Clearly, there seems to be some definite interaction between the mayor's office. But I want to come back. When we come back from the break, I want to get into the fact that they specifically targeted certain council members. And we'll get into that. This is, once again, an excellent story from the Minnesota Reformer. It's much longer. I've actually trimmed this down dramatically. I know it's long, but I've trimmed this down dramatically to try to get this in today because I think this is important. It, you know, if you can't, you know, if you have to use, you know, puppet groups to basically push your agenda, now, I don't know. Are you really serving the people? 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. Once again, Paul Metza coming up here in a little bit to talk about Dylan. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950.
Everybody get up.
So you get this group, Operation Safety Now. It's trying to pass himself off as this grassroots group that's just concerned about, doesn't want to see the level of police reform that most of the people of the city of Minneapolis is putting forward. So they try to put themselves off as just a grassroots campaign of local Minnesota, Minneapolis residents who think that, you know, some changes are needed, but nothing that much. You find out the group has been coordinating directly on a lot of messages with Minneapolis Police Department, on some messages with the mayor's office, and including advising the mayor on certain strategy points. But then we get to the city council themselves. During the budget debate, Rodriguez and One, the two people from Operation Safety Now, identified three potential swing votes to target on the council: Andrea Jenkins, Johnson, and Cano. Now, Johnson spoke to Rodriguez several times, he said, but voted against Safety Now's positions in the end. Jenkins voted in line with Operation Safety Now, but the emails do not show any coordination between her and One and Rodriguez, although they did had reached out to her. Cano, however, met with the men before switching sides in the debate and supporting their positions on key votes. As late as October of 28th, Cano was undeterred in her push to abolish our current policing system, she told the NPR News people. On November 10th, the City Council Budget Committee approved a one-time allocation of $500,000 so the Minneapolis Police Department could contract with other law enforcement agencies and fill the gap left when hundreds of officers quit or took time off after the May, June, and civil unrest. Jenkins, Johnson, Cano all had publicly vowed to abolish Minneapolis police, but voted to advance the question to the full council, which approved it on November 13th with their support. On November 15th, Rodriguez wrote to Cano's policy aide to schedule a meeting with the council member. He included a Washington Post article about Minneapolis residents who were concerned about crime. The residents quoted in the article were Karen Forbes, George Saad, S-A-A-D, and Kathy Spann, S-P-A-N-N, all Safety Now members or leaders, though the article does not say that. So once again, Washington Post runs an article talking to all these people, and it basically just they present it as, oh, these are just regular residents when they're part of their organization. In follow-up emails, Rodriguez looped in one who he wrote had extensive connections with federal, state, and municipal governments. Given his connections, he'd be in a position to help Ms. Cano with some of what she wants to achieve for the Lake Street Corridor and the Latino community, Rodriguez wrote. The men met with Cano on November 19th. After the meeting, the council member helped set up a meeting between Rodriguez 1 and members of the Lake Street Latino Business Association. I share the Lake Street Latino Business Association as looking for fundraising and capacity support, Cano wrote to her conversation with Rodriguez and 1. On December 9th, Cano and Jenkins were the swing votes that blocked an effort to lower the maximum number of authorized Minneapolis Police Department officers. This is the same issue which Fry threatened to veto the budget and has been cited by both sides as a key victory for those supporting the Minneapolis police. Most paid lobbyists, including municipal lobbyists, need to register with the State of Minnesota Campaign Finance Public Disclosure Board. Neither one nor Rodriguez are. I'd be interested in finding out if their consulting businesses have any new contracts. That would be me. Find out who's paying those contracts, if they do exist. It's wrong for Republicans to run fake marijuana, pro-marijuana candidates in ways to try to sneak in an agenda. I would make an argument it does no one any good to have the Minneapolis police coordinating with a quote-unquote grassroots organization that is pushing a very pro-police agenda, advising the mayor's office on how to strong-arm his position, and let's just call it what it is, potentially corrupting city council members into going along with the agenda through, you know, whether it's, I don't know if you want to call it a bribe or not, but it's a, you know, well, we'll look at some economic development in your community. If all of a sudden, you know, if we can get what we want, we can maybe try to help you get what you want. And I don't, you know, and because that was, I got to remind people, Cano voting, when Cano voted against dropping the number of cops, that was a shocker. Because she had been, all last summer, one of the biggest vocal opponents of the police, how they needed to be reined in, how we needed to strip down the entire system and start all over again. And then all of a sudden come the first vote and things changed. I think we have to look at, there needs to be a full investigation here. And we cannot have a small handful of people who, once again, might not even be Minneapolis residents. That is pretty clear here as well. There's a legitimate question on whether this guy, who is claiming to be a resident of Minneapolis, is really actually a resident of Richfield, coming in and creating a what might, even in the best case scenario, might it look like some sort of grassroots group, but if you don't know the level of the coordination and extensive relationship with the Minneapolis Police Department, you would never have any idea as how kind of corrupt the entire system is. I'm disappointed on a lot of levels. I'm going to be honest. I do like Chief Arredondo. I like Mayor Fry at times, and I like Councilmember Cano. But this is deeply disturbing. And in case anyone's missing the point, We clearly have a serious problem with policing in the city of Minneapolis. That is undeniable still today. And as opposed to people on one side saying, okay, what can we do to change things? They're instead going with a what could be described as a deceitful technique to try to basically keep things as much status quo as possible. And that's not acceptable. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. It is Bob Dylan's 80th birthday. Paul Metza, I've seen the picture of the cake they had up at Dylan's house up in Hibbing. He sent me a picture. We're going to talk to Paul Metza when we do come on back and talk about the impact of Dylan today. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Oh, that's the young and spry 80-year-old Bob Dylan right there on his birthday. Paul Metza, of course, our Power Radio Hour, Wall of Power 8 Radio Hour is here 6 to 7 on Saturday nights. Paul, of course, an iconic musician himself from the Northland. He's kind enough today to join us to talk about Bob Dylan's birthday as well as his long-term legacy. Hi, Paul.
Hey, man, thanks for calling.
No, my pleasure. Thank you. I know this is a busy day for you. You had cake up there. You're at his house.
We had cupcakes, and they actually had a really nice birthday cake. I texted you the photo, so you could probably post it at your convenience. But, yeah, I came up last night. I was invited to play a song for the Duluth Does Dylan CD recording project. I think this is seventh year. So I came up and I recorded Bob Dylan's Dream last night, and so the timing was perfect. We didn't plan on me being here for his birthday, but as I was, I took part in a great celebration right at the Bob Dylan childhood home on 3rd Avenue East. There was musicians and a St. Louis County commissioner read a proclamation. They named it the Bob Dylan Year in St. Louis County, and a lot of cool people, and the cake was really good.
Well, and then it is wonderful that we can still celebrate such a unique talent and a unique legacy. You know, from I always like starting talking about you because you are a phenomenal musician, and you're iconic with your own career and your own sound. But you can't deny the fact that you yourself, talk about how much you were driven by Bob Dylan.
Oh, I used to, Matt. You know, I grew up in Virginia, Minnesota. You know that town.
Oh, yeah.
You've got to live there.
Oh yeah,
20 miles east of Hibbing. So when I was in junior high and high school, occasionally I'd hitchhike over and just stand in front of his house on 7th Avenue, just a few blocks south of the Hibbing High School. And I'd look at that front door, Matt, and I'd go, you know, the guy that walked out of that front door as a young man went out and changed American culture and songwriting as we know it. So he's remained a great inspiration, and that he's still working, getting ready to go on the road again and just put out one of his greatest records, Rough and Rowdy Ways, at 80 years old is just a phenomenal testament to his work ethic, which is, as far as I'm concerned, Matt, it's an iron range work ethic. His guitar is his lunch pail, and off to work he goes day after day for 60 plus years.
And you can't deny that. And I think for me, where I see Bob Dylan everywhere still today is not so much over like 1st Avenue, 7th Street entry, but the times I've gone around and I'll see some 17-year-old kid with a guitar and he's just sitting on a park bench or he's in a coffee house and he or she feels as if they've got enough to say and it's important for them to try to say it and that the idea that they can be someone from nowhere. And yet they still have something major to say and have the ability to do that through music. I think that, you know, that's something you see. I don't care the genre. I don't care the individual. That is still, I mean, that's the Dylan influence today.
Oh, absolutely. He's opened so many doors for so many people. And he's, you know, people, he's got fans like Lady Gaga and Tony Bennett and, you know, Kanye West and, you know, rappers and blues cats and jazz cats. You know, the other thing I want to say, speaking about Northern Minnesota, he, you know, Bob, he's won the Academy Awards and Grammy Awards, sold 200 million records. But he, in 2018, he won, or was it 2016, he won the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Yes.
And you can trace that right back to his 11th and 12th grade humanities and English teacher, a fella I had the pleasure of meeting. I actually interviewed him. We played the interview on the Wall of Power Radio Hour. And his name was B.J. Rolfson. And he said Bob was one of his best students. And I heard that B.J. told me that Bob came up to him at an event in Hibbing. I think somebody had passed away, and he saw him at the synagogue. And as he was walking out, Bob walked up to Mr. Rolfson and said, B.J., he said, you are my greatest influence. So I think the Iron Range work ethic, combined with the power of the St. Louis County school system, created the groundwork for a young Bobby Zimmerman to become Bob Dylan, who hitchhiked to New York in January with a guitar, and who hitchhikes in the middle of winter to New York from Minneapolis? An Iron Ranger.
Someone that doesn't think it's that cold. But, you know, that's one of the better points, too, I think, is that one of the things I've come to realize is that there's a lot of people, I think, in Minnesota that resented Dylan because they felt like he left. And the reality is that he was never escaping Minnesota. That, as you just described perfectly, the Minnesota permeated him, and he just took it elsewhere. It was never about abandoning the past. It was about embracing who he was.
That's exactly it. And he still, you know, he's got a farm west of town. I heard he's got a couple of buddies that have lake cabins outside of Hibbing. And so he comes up. He gets his Minnesota fix every summer. There was a great story when he played in Duluth about 20 years ago. And the Duluth News Tribune were interviewing people from Hibbing, and they talked to this old-timer who was probably younger than Dylan is today. They said, have you ever seen Bob Dylan up here? And the guy goes, no. He goes, but last summer I saw a 20-foot black stretch limo come through town with a canoe on top.
is Bob a big canoer?
Well, he goes, you know, I would put nothing past that guy, you know?
When you look back at his deep discography, I think the best way to kind of look at it is you look through the kind of as the decades go. Why don't you talk a little bit about, you know, from your perspective as a musician, the better albums that, you know, as we are, is 80th anniversary, and there are a lot of people, there are a lot of younger people out there that might not have experienced Dylan. If you want to drive people to specific albums, which ones, as you go through his career, would you say, you know what, you can't miss with that?
Well, there's, you know, 39 bona fide studio releases, but what I would suggest to anyone, young or old, to dig is some of these bootleg series they've been putting out, where a lot of the songs never made it on the regular records. Song like Blind Willie McTell, which he recorded with Mark Knopfler for Infidels, never made it on the record, but it came on a box set in 85. And now you can track that one down. I think you can find something in every record he's put on. A record I really love that I was listening on my way to Duluth yesterday is called Under the Red Sky. Mm-hmm. And that record got panned when it came out. It's got a song called Born in Time and the title track, Under the Red Sky, with a great slide guitar solo by George Harrison. It's just lovely. So you might not need every song to resonate with you, but there's good stuff on every record. Now, you got to dig. The guy's written over 600 songs, and he built his style on the bedrock of Roots American music, blues, country, bluegrass, folk, and he's got a gospel influence, and he can improvise, like a jazz cat. So he is really a master musicologist who absorbed every style of American music, coupled it with his voracious reading habits. He loves reading about the Civil War, his love of surrealism, poetry, and all the great poets. You know, the Italian poet from the 13th century, as the song says, and Tangled Up in Blue. So he's an amalgamation of all the great American cultural influences that we had. And then he's absorbed everything else that he's read and heard in his life. He's just an amazing human being. We are lucky, I think, Matt, to live in his time.
Mm-hmm. I always love the fact that he got to New York to see Woody Guthrie.
Yeah.
Before Guthrie died. Go ahead.
No, I actually had a conversation with Ramblin' Jack Elliott about a project that I'm kind of keeping on the QT right now. But Ramblin' Jack said, yeah, he goes, I remember the day Bob showed up to visit Woody at the hospital. And it's like, you know, for me, that's like going back and meeting Moses and going, Moses, that sixth commandment, how did you come up with that one? That sounds a lot killer. It's a killer commandment, you know. But so for me, you know, I love, you know, listening to Dylan, studying Dylan, and then all of his influences. Once you get into the guy, you realize he's got his touchstones are scattered all over the American landscape.
You know, and you said it earlier, and I want to bring this back again. He did not meet these people in the way that a lot of modern musicians will team up with someone so they can do this glitzy, look who I'm working with now. As you said, you talk about, oh, he worked with Knopfler, he worked with Harrison. You usually didn't find out about those people being involved at these albums until, oh, George Harrison's on this album. You know, he looked at Guthrie, and I think that everyone that he worked with as kind of a worker training program, that it was a way for him to, I'm going to make myself better. How do I do it? And it was never about the glory. It was about being the best musician he possibly could be.
You're absolutely right, man. You know, he used to call himself, when he moved out to New York, and before that, he was learning the stuff in Dinky Town. He called himself a Woody Guthrie jukebox. And you can go back and hear so many tapes where he'll do, you know, he'll be sitting around a coffee table, he'll sing 25 Woody Guthrie songs, you know, without missing a verse. No, he's a very studied musician that has absorbed every important American music style.
Yes.
Which is what, that's one of his lessons to a young Paul Metza, was like, listen to everybody, read everything. Don't be afraid to try a style you're uncomfortable with. And he did it, and what you really have to appreciate, he did it suffering the slings and arrows of outrageous criticism from every corner, and it never stopped him.
I've always been a fan of Desolation Row.
Oh yeah,
I that is a dark. That is a dark song. I mean, the way that he could write. I mean, either you talk about it goes all genres. I mean, I hear in him gospel and country and blues, bluesgrass. I hear hard rock. I hear prog. You hear pop music. It just he was never afraid to just be who he was. And I think once again, going back to that first point is, don't be afraid. Just go do it. You can be a guy from Hibbing, Minnesota, in Iron Range, and go on out there and become one of the most influential musicians in the history of mankind, but you just got to go do it.
You know, Eric Clapton, I mean, I've learned enough about him, and I've met a lot of Bob's friends over the years, and I worked with Bucky Baxter, who produced a record of mine called Whistling Past the Graveyard, while he was playing in Bob Dylan's band. And so I get a lot of the inside track stuff, which is really fun. But I remember Eric Clapton said something like, Dylan, he goes, the only guy I know, we could be on stage in front of 100,000 people, and he'll turn his back to the audience and teach you the song you're about to play. That's balls, baby.
I will be remiss. I want to ask you one thing. Tomorrow we celebrate, we celebrate Bob Dylan today. Tomorrow we're going to remember what happened to George Floyd. The long-term, the social impact of Bob Dylan And that although two very different people known for two very different reasons, you can't deny that both of them were trying to change society as we know it.
Absolutely. And, you know, I don't want to sound self-serving, but I wrote a new version of my song, Slow Justice, that I wrote in 1984 originally for the P9 strike down in Austin, Minnesota. And then I recently recut, you can find it's called Slow Justice 2.0, with a line that references George Floyd and, you know, the unrest that we went through here in Minneapolis. And but Dylan, you know, what he got through was the first one to really start singing about songs of social justice. And then Bob was able to take those lessons and put his take on it with his huge platform and really created and highlighted the civil rights movement in the 1960s as we knew it. I had a beautiful evening with producer Bob Johnston, who produced Simon and Garfunkel and Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison and several Bob Dylan records. And he told me as we were driving on one smoky evening through the hills of Austin, Texas, the foothills, and he said, you know, Bob Dylan stopped the Vietnam War. And his point was his songs like Blown in the Wind and The Times They're Changing. That was the song that gave the folks at that time songs to sing, energy to take this to the streets. And so you still see the reverberations of that with the incredible outpouring of support after the tragic murder of George Floyd. May he rest in peace.
Indeed. And that we're going to be living with the impact of Bob Dylan and George Floyd for so long. I will say this. It's still great that we're able to celebrate Bob. It's amazing he's going back on the road.
Well, he's he's been doing 100 dates a year for 30 years. It's called a never-ending tour, you know. And you think about it. It's, you know, you go out and play a two-hour show. As a musician, I know what that takes, you know, to be on for 2 hours to play. But then you're also talking about 12 hours in a van or 12, you know, he's got a nice tour bus. But so, you know, he spent his life doing his work, and God bless him. I mean, even if you don't dig his music, you got to dig his work ethic, man. Yeah. Because who has a job anymore, the same job for 60 freaking years? You know who does? Bob Dylan.
Yeah. That's exactly it. Paul Metso, Wall of Power Radio Hour, 6 to 7 on Saturdays. We're going to go on out, Paul. This is a song that you did. It's My Back Pages. Talk about this really quick before we play it.
One of my favorite Bob Dylan songs that has the great line, I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now. Bob Dylan's younger than that now at 80 than he was when he wrote it. And I did it, and I had a couple of guys from Blood on the Tracks, Peter Ostrowski and Kevin Odegaard. Peter Lang played on it. Matt Fink was on piano from Prince's band. We did it about 10 or 11 years ago at Wolf Park in St. Louis Park. It's a live version. You're playing the version from YouTube, which people can track down.
Paul, thank you very much. I'll repost that a little bit later myself. Thank you, Paul. All my best. Have a great day. Drive safe, my friend.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks for the phone call. You too. Bye-bye.
My pleasure. Paul Metza. It's always better when we get Paul Metza on the air. Let's play that song. We'll play this for a little bit as we go on out here. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950.
Falling high, mighty track. How much fire on flame and roll? Using ideas in my mind. We'll meet on edges soon, said I. Pride me, deed and pride. Oh, but I was so much older than I'm younger than. Prejudice leads for rip down all heat of scream. Life's in life is black and white, ripped from my skull a dream. Romantic facts of musketeer.
How about the assertion that Dylan was responsible for the end of the Vietnam War? The power of music, folks. That, and You know, there's a lot of things that were going on there, but you can't deny the fact that the music and the culture of the time was, you know, was very much turning public sentiment against a pointless war. I said this when we started talking to Paul, that I see Dylan everywhere. When you see a kid, and as a person who's 52 years old now, most of the people who are starting to play music are kids. You see it with every kid who grabs a guitar and says, I got something important to say. And Dylan, I mean, there was a story. Was it Dean Phillips that talked about a story? It was his great-great-grandfather hired this kid out of the University of Minnesota to come play music. And he thought he was so bad, he basically rounded him up after like three songs and sent him home. And what I think Dylan needed was trying to understand was that he was, like I said, he never was trying to abandon Minnesota. I just think that he was thinking on a different level than where Minnesota was at that point. And going in and getting in there and talking to Guthrie and being around these legends and getting the range work ethic and applying it to something like music. And I've actually read about this in a few different ways of certain jobs and positions, which generally are not considered to be kind of lunch pail, time clock kind of jobs. And that the people that treat those jobs like that end up having a tremendous amount of success. I mean, Malcolm Gladwell actually wrote a little bit about that as well. And that you know, he put the time in, and it was never about the success. It was never about this. It was about saying the message that he had in his head and getting it out. And he realized that it was just not, you know, a year at the University of Minnesota. It was not going to work there. And so off to New York he went. And he did. He did change the world. And, you know, if you've not listened to some of his albums, I mean, they're just as iconic, especially some of those 60s albums, are just as iconic as any music that's ever been produced. A lot of people tried their hardest to try to be influencers. The reality is that it's just something that there are just cats. There are just people out there that are just wired different. And Dylan was one of them. Dylan was one of them. I need to stop and say, happy birthday to Robert Pilot. Native Roots Radio is coming up after this show. Pilot's birthday. Get him. Go get him. Happy birthday is all across the board. Robert, happy birthday to you, my friend. I hope you have a good one. Tomorrow, it is going to be the remembrance of George Floyd, 1 year from the time that Derek Chauvin and three other officers murdered him in the street. We'll be talking about that. Till tomorrow. See ya.